Welcome back to Monsters Among Us. If you are new here, my name is Kate Moser, and each week we explore the question, are monsters real? This week, we dive into the story of America's most haunted hotel. The Crescent Hotel and Spa has been visited by over 70 paranormal investigation teams, from TAPS to Ghost Adventures. This massive and striking building is home to ghosts who, when alive, trusted their lives to a madman and a con artist. Sit back, get comfy, because here we go. Eureka Springs, Arkansas is home to over 60 healing springs. The warm waters have been drawing crowds for hundreds of years. During the Civil War, a doctor named Alva Jackson, who brought his son to Eureka Springs in hopes of curing his eye condition. When it was fully cured, the doctor decided to stay and help out soldiers from both sides, especially during the Battle of Pea Ridge. Amazed by the spring's healing powers, he also invited a prominent judge, L.B. Sanders, to the city to help with his leg. Knowing the potential for profit, the Eureka Springs Improvement Company was formed and partnered up with the Frisco Railroad to bring tourists to the areas. People from far and wide flocked to Eureka Springs to bathe in the healing water. From hay fever to baldness to female troubles to cancer, the healing springs of Eureka Springs were a cure-all, or so the newspapers claimed. With the booming tourism, a hotel was needed. So, in 1886, the Crescent Hotel was built on a 27-acre land plot. According to a newspaper clipping from the time, the Crescent Hotel offered the visiting vacationer opulence unmatched in convenience and service. Standing five stories high, this hotel is magnificent. Hard white river limestone was used, and architects had to call in the help of specialists from Ireland to help build the structure, since this limestone was so unique and apparently was really dense. So they needed specialists to help be able to break it down and use it. Total cost of the project was $294,000, which is equivalent to around $8.5 million today. The Crescent Hotel has changed ownership on multiple occasions during its history. It was leased to the railroad in 1902, and due to slow business during the winter months, the hotel became a women's college called the Crescent College for Young Women from 1908 to 1935. In 1937, it was purchased by a Norman baker and turned into a cancer hospital, and this is where our haunted tale begins. The following information comes from an article published on crescent-hotel.com. In the spring of 1930, John Tunis's wife Lula began dying of cancer. In his private moments, he must have alternately begged God not to take his wife and cursed him for letting her suffer such a cruel end. By the end of May, Lula was running out of time. John placed her and their dwindling hopes in the hands of a man named Norman Baker. They prayed he could provide the cure that the medical establishment could not. And by all appearances, they had reason to hope. Norman Baker was the founder of the Baker Institute in Mascatane, Iowa. He was a medical quote-unquote genius with a new cure for cancer. Always dressed in a white suit and lavender tie, he owned a radio station in Mascatane with the call letters KTNT, which stood for Know the Naked Truth. He took to the airwaves and declared war on big business and the American Medical Association. He believed that organized medicine was corrupt and chose profit over patients. He preached the gospel of alternative medicine. He was the self-proclaimed champion of the common man against the ownership class. He was on the Tunis' side, and he had a cure. It was doubtful that John and Lula could have known much about the background of their savior. That he was a former magician, turned inventor, turned millionaire businessman, turned pulpist radio host, turned cancer doctor without a day of medical training in his life. They couldn't have known that Norman's magical elixir was nothing more than a useless mix of watermelon seed, brown corn silk, alcohol, and carbolic acid. They clearly didn't know that all Norman Baker had to offer was an excruciating pseudo-treatment and the betrayal of their last hope. But in time, they learned. John Tunis would later testify in court against Norman Baker. She took the needle treatments. She told me it was awful, that 5 or 7 needles a day were stuck into her, and they would hold them there until the medicine ran out. She said it didn't do much good. She said she wanted to go home, that she was getting worse. She was in terrible shape when she left the Baker Institute and went down in bed right away. Lula was dead by Christmas. In the introduction of Norman's bought and paid for biography, Doctors, Dynaminers, and Guinemen, authored Alvin Winston wrote, "This is an inspiration book for young and old, a fact story of how a man fought his enemies, how he faced gunmen, dynamiters, and enemy doctors, how he fought the medical racket, the radio trust, the aluminum trust, and others. He did it for you. There has never been a book prepared so carefully. This makes the most important book ever written. Read the life story of Norman Baker, the greatest one-man battle ever fought." This was how Norman Baker wanted the world to see him, as a crusader who fought to protect the common man against exploitation. But behind the mask of humanitarianism, he was a man who leached off the sick and dying to make hundreds of thousands of dollars. Although tragic, Lula's story is far from unique. It could be interchanged with hundreds of others, desperate cancer sufferers who came to Norman Baker looking for a cure, but found only suffering and death. It was the way of things at the Baker hospitals in Muscatine, Iowa, and Eureka Springs, Arkansas, for nearly a decade. Norman Baker was born on November 27, 1882, in Muscatine, Iowa. He was the youngest of 10 children. In 1898, at the age of 16, Norman quit high school to take a job as a mechanist. For a few years, he traveled from town to town working as a die and tool maker where he could. Then one night, Norman saw a mental suggestion magic show by a performer named Professor Flint. Norman was captivated by Flint's abilities and resolved to start a similar show of his own. After a few false starts, Norman got his performance troupe off the ground in 1904. The star of his show was a mind reader with a stage name, Madame Pearl Tagley. The show was a hit and found an audience on the vaudeville circuit. According to Norman's biography, the show drew 300 a week. In 1909, the original Madame Tagley decided to quit the troupe. A college girl named Teresa Pinder replaced her, and a year later, Norman and Teresa married. The show continued for another 4 years until the summer of 1914. Mr. and Mrs. Baker found themselves in Muscatine again for a long break from the show. They had intended to go back out on the road again in the fall, but fate intervened. While tinkering in his brother's machine shop that summer, Norman came up with an invention for a new kind of organ called an air cilliophone. It was played with air rather than steam, making it much more efficient. He sold the first one for $500, just under $10,000 in today's money. He made two more and sold them immediately. Suddenly, the amusement business didn't seem so attractive anymore. He decided to quit altogether and manufacture his new invention. It soon made him a very wealthy man. 1915 was a big year of change for Baker. He quit the theater business, divorced his wife, and became a full-time manufacturer. At the height, this business pulled in $200,000 a year. In 1920, Norman opened an art correspondence school called the Tangley School. He freely admitted that he could not draw at all himself, but that didn't stop him from netting over $75,000 in 3 years, teaching other people how to do it. Norman always tries to cloak his business maneuverings as civil duty or human crusade, but he never undertook any adventure that didn't come with a healthy profit margin. So it was no surprise in 1925 when Norman went to the Muscatine Chamber of Commerce under the guise of civic duty and offered to build a radio station that would popularize Muscatine, Iowa throughout the world. All he asked for in return for his gesture was free electricity, water, and taxes. The city fathers gave Norman what he wanted. He promised daily talks about Muscatine to publicize in hope of luring new industries and employers to the sleepy Iowa town. It'll lift Muscatine from being a little burg lost in Mississippi cornfields to a city the whole world knows about, Norman promised. Norman secured a license for a 500-watt station. He chose the now infamous call letters KTNT. He built his station on the highest hill in Muscatine, which overlooked the Mississippi River. Norman postured that his station would be a beacon of light for the masses, the hordes of farmers and laborers and small businessmen, as well as humanity in general. On Thanksgiving Day, 1925, KTNT took to the air for the first time. Norman understood the natural unease and distress of rural populations had towards urban big business. He came out swinging at them, framing the argument as little KTNT versus the radio trust. He was fighting for the freedom of the airwaves, and his message resounded loudly with his rural audience. His broadcast consisted of interweaving of his attacks on the American Medical Association, Aluminum Trust, and Wall Street, and pitching his many mail-ordered products. Norman grasped the power of the radio quickly, recognizing it was a way to raise his own profile to unprecedented heights and sell more product. KTNT was only licensed for 500 watts, but often broadcast at 10,000. In 1928, Baker legally received license to broadcast at 10,000 watts, meaning his signal could reach well over 1 million homes. Norman had been a prominent man in the community for well over a decade, but the stature and influence his radio station gave him was exponentially larger than anything he had ever known. KTNT became one of the most prominent radio stations in the Midwest. On weekends and holidays, thousands would gather at the station to hear Norman's broadcast. Baker welcomed the crowds with live entertainment as well as souvenirs, food, and cheap gasoline. All for a fair price, of course. As KTNT popularity grew, Norman's attack on his usual targets became more personal, I guess. He made baseless personal attacks on prominent men he considered enemies, accusing them over the airwaves of everything from adultery to drunkenness. This behavior began to turn people against him, and there was a backlash of complaints against KTNT. Had Norman stuck to heckling all of the boogeymen of rural America, like the AMA and Wall Street, he most likely would have lived out his days in Muscatine as a rich and prominent citizen. But in 1929, he chose a path that led directly to his own ruin. Norman became aware of a Dr. Charles Ozas, who was operating a cancer sanatorium out of Kansas City. Norman claimed that in interest of the public good, he wished to investigate whether or not Dr. Ozas cured worked. Over the KTNT airwaves, he called for 5 volunteers to be treated in Kansas City, with Norman footing the bill. He soon had his 5 volunteers and sent them to Ozas for treatment for several months in the spring and summer of 1929. Norman planned to publish an article in the December 1929 issue of his new magazine, TNT, that related his findings. He asserted that using aluminum products, especially aluminum cooking utensils, caused cancer. He warned that cancer was not curable through operation, radium, and X-ray. His new cure used none of these. He referred to surgeons as cutters. Norman's cure was non-surgical, a series of injections that would eat the cancer without harming the surrounding tissue. The public could now rest easy that there was someone who would cure cancer without carving them up. There was just one problem. His test patients were starting to die. The first one passed on November 25th. In December, TNT hit the newsstands anyway, with the front page proclaiming, "Cancer is cured," over a smiling picture of Baker and two associates. 3 days after Christmas, the second test patient died. The third and fourth patients died in January and February, and in March, Norman reprinted the December TNT issue detailing the miraculous recovery of his five test patients. In May of 1930, the last test patient died, and Norman reprinted the TNT issue again without changing a word. He acquired the cure from Ozas in January of 1930 and opened the Baker Institute in Mascotene. The formula was a solution containing glycerin, carbolic acid, and alcohol, which was mixed with tea brewed from watermelon seed, brown corn silk, and clover leaves. He used KTNT to advertise his new hospital. In March of 1930, he hired Harry Horksey, another famous cancer quack, to use Horksey's treatments. Some found it curious that Norman would hire Horksey's and his treatment if he already had a cure. However, Horksey's hiring didn't slow business at the Institute. In the calendar year of 1930, Norman made over $444,000 from cancer sufferers alone, roughly equivalent to $16 million today. In April of 1930, Norman Baker found himself in the crosshairs of Morris Fishbein and the American Medical Association. Fishbein was the editor of the Journal of the AMA. He had made it a personal mission to expose the quackery in JAMA. Fishbein recognized that Baker's attack were undermining people's trust in the medical establishment and went to work putting Norman Baker out of the cancer business. They published multiple articles exposing Baker and his quackery. In the April 12, 1930 edition of JAMA, they wrote, "In Iowa, at Mascotene, over KTNT, broadcast a businessman named Norman Baker, who is selling a cancer cure with cigars and cheap magazines as sidelines. His cancer cure includes the old Hulksey fake, originally promoted in Illinois and apparently now resident also in Iowa. This Nordstrom for cancer is boomed by Mr. Baker over his radio station KTNT, which can be heard almost everywhere from after 11 o'clock at night. This is exceedingly proper since it is the time of night when many devious and doubtful ventures are promoted. Baker has even claimed that the American Medical Association offered him $1 million for his cancer cure with the intent of forcing it from the market so that patients might be compelled to resort to surgery for saving of their lives. This lie is obviously false to any person of intelligence above that of a moron that is needs so little thought to convince his hearers of its falsity. Even if the AMA had a loose $1 million lying around ready to be spent, it is quite certain that the number of better ways for spending it would occur to the trustees who are responsible for the funds of the association. What is Mr. Baker doing with that money he is snaring from the pockets of sufferers with cancer and weeding the funds of chiropractors, naturopaths, Nordstrom promoters, and other medical malcontents? The viciousness of Mr. Baker's broadcasting lies not in what he says about the AMA, but in the fact that he induces sufferers from cancer who might some chance for their lives. if seen early and properly treated, to resort to his Nordstrom. The method can result in Mascotene, Iowa, as it did in Taylorville, Illinois, merely in death certificates signed by the physicians who have been so poor in finances and in morals as to sell their birthrights to Mr. Baker for his mess of garbage. A week later, Norman was again the target in a follow-up story. Norman Baker's cancer cure quackery at Mascotene, Iowa, has been dealt with by the Des Moines Register. Not only did this paper reprint the statement of the journal relative to Baker and KTNT, but it also made an investigation of its own, which established the utter falsehood of the claims made by him in his radio talks. The medical profession, of course, needed no evidence, but a credulous public must be convinced by personal study. The investigation made by the Register revealed many deaths from cancer among the Baker clientele. It revealed the menace of Bakerism to be his vicious influence against modern scientific diagnosis and treatment and modern public health work. It brought to light a Baker who trims his claims to the winds that blow. To all of this, what does Baker answer? Merely that he is being persecuted by the medical trust, that he is benefiting 25% of cancers, and that the Des Moines Register is cowardly, contemptible, and dirty. Does this sad old world, after all, afford any spectacle so terrible or so ignominious as an exposed cancer quack? The state licensing boards, the state prosecuting officials, and the other constituted authorities of Kansas and of Iowa owe it to the people of the states to rid their communities as soon as possible from these blatant quacks. The Federal Radio Commission must be dependent on by the people in their states to spare them the possibility of hearing the obscene mouthings and pernicious promotions that are broadcast by the stations that these quacks dominate. If these authoritative bodies do not function for the good of the people, our government must find some system that will. Norman was livid. He struck back on multiple fronts. The following month, he filed a $500,000 lawsuit against the AMA for libel and defamation. He went so far as to accuse the AMA of sending three assassins to KTNT to silence him. According to Norman, a gunfight ensued between himself and the assailants. He and Hoxies wounded one of the thugs before he and his fellow gunmen made their getaway. Baker filed a report with police, but nothing ever came of it due to lack of evidence. Finally, in an attempt to sway public opinion against the AMA and his other critics, he held a public demonstration of his cure on May 12th. An estimated 40 to 50,000 people came to Mascotene to watch Norman's demonstration. He had sent out a call from KTNT to see an outdoor exhibition of his cure. His days of running his theater troupe had taught him how to manipulate a crowd. He warmed them up with stories of miraculous healing from former patients who one by one gave their own accounts to the crowd. To allay fears that his cure was harmful, he drank an enormous dose of his cancer cure and showed no ill effects. The main event was open to air surgery on a 68-year-old man named Mandis Johnson. One of the Baker Institute's doctors opened up the skull of Johnson while he was still conscious. Baker then applied his cure to what he claimed was cancerous brain tissue and echoed the statement from the cover of the December issue of TNT. "Cancer is cured," he said. Now that he had thoroughly won over his audience, Norman could turn to his real purpose, damage control against the AMA attacks. He launched into a fiery talk against the medical trust. He charged them with choosing profits over patients and told the crowd that initials MD really stood for more dough. Norman promised the people that he would not let them let up in his fight with the medical trust and reminded the crowd that it was them he was fighting for. The open-air demonstration and his daily radio barrages combined to create booming business for the Baker Institute. New patients arrived daily, hoping that Baker's miracle was true. Patients like Lula Tennis. As the Institute flourished, organized medical turned up the heat on Norman. New articles appeared in the Journal of American Medical Association. They even debunked the brain operation on Mandus Johnson as a hoax. Johnson had a condition that caused the inflammation of the outer skull. What the gaping crowd saw at that demonstration was not the man's brain, but the medullary portion of the man's skull, the article said. Beginning in 1931, things began to unravel for Norman. The AMA actively lobbied the Federal Radio Commission to revoke Baker's radio license. In May of 1931, they officially refused to renew his license and forced him from the air. Norman's suit against the AMA was ruled against him, and his reputation took a beating. A steady stream of relatives and former patients testified in court and recounted Norman's sins in public. The final blow was an arrest warrant issued against him for practicing medicine without a license. Norman fled to Mexico to build a new 100,000-watt radio station that would be out of the legal reach of the Federal Radio Commission. Norman remained in Mexico until 1937, broadcasting from his station and trying to influence from a distance. He even ran a small cancer hospital there, but he grew restless. He returned to Mascotene, pled guilty, and served a one-day sentence for practicing medicine without a license. After an unsuccessful bid for Iowa's Senate seat, Norman left Mascotene for good. Having been run out of his home state, Norman moved to Arkansas, this time to Orzox and the town of Eureka Springs. There, he bought a majestic Victorian hotel that had fallen on hard times, the Crescent Hotel, which he called Castle in the Air, and he made it the new location for the Baker Hospital. Norman picked up where he had left off in Iowa, running the same medical scams that had made him hundreds of thousands of dollars. According to one U.S. postal inspector, Norman was pulling in $500,000 a year at Eureka Springs. For 2 years, he thrived in there, but the clock was ticking on Norman. He was now a marked man by federal authorities. They quietly investigated him, and in 1939, they closed in. After 10 years of being hounded by authorities and the AMA, all it took to bring Baker down was 7 letters placed in the United States Mail advertising his services. Norman Baker was arrested by federal authorities and charged with using the mails to defraud. The trial was held in January of 1940 in Little Rock, and Norman was found guilty on all 7 accounts. He appealed the decision but was denied. The opinion handed down by the Court of Appeals said that Norman's cancer cure was a pure hoax. In January of 1940, Norman arrived at the Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary to serve a 4-year sentence. One investigator wrote, "Our investigation indicates that Baker and his associates defrauded cancer sufferers out of approximately $4 million. And remember, that's their time. Our investigation further shows that a great majority of people who were actually suffering with cancer who took the treatment lived but a short while after returning to their homes from the hospital. We believed that the treatment hastened the death of the sufferers in most cases. It appears to us that the sentence of 4 years which Baker received and the fine of $4,000 was extremely light penalty under the circumstances. He was no longer Norman Baker, millionaire businessman and cancer maverick. He was now simply known as inmate 58197. In a statement in the warden's report, Norman said, "I am not guilty. They have never proved anything in the indictment. We figure this is a railroading proposition." It is in my opinion that the jury was fixed and influenced. We have hired private detectives to look into the matter. It is believed that whiskey and women were made available to the jurors. We were railroaded by the American Medical Association, who have been after me for years. Sorry, I'm laughing. It's just, this guy is just insane. Norman was released from Leavenworth on July 19th, 1944. He retired to Florida and lived comfortably until his death in 1958. What made Norman Baker's cancer cure charade so despicable is the human cost of his fraud. Hundreds of people who might have lived if they received legitimate medical care died because they put their trust in his cure. The common grifter swindles people out of their money, but only a monster would do that at the cost of their last chance of survival. So, was Norman a greedy psychopath devoid of conscience, or was simply a delusional man who convinced himself that his cure really worked? After interviewing Norman, the Leavenworth psychiatrist concluded that he was delusional and that Baker did not believe that he had done anything wrong. But Norman's own words revealed a different sentiment. While serving his sentence at the Leavenworth, no longer burdened with keeping up appearances for the public, he let his guard down. "If I could keep my radio station open," he said, "I would make $1 million out of the suckers of the states." After the demise of Norman Baker, the hotel was purchased by four men: Herbert Byfield, John Constantine, Dwight Nichols, and Herbert Shutter. The men hoped to restore the hotel to its originality, since Baker had done some major conversions during his stay. These men even struck a deal with a local railroad to make travel vacation packages. Business was good. However, in 1967, the hotel suffered a massive fire that destroyed much of the fourth and fifth floors. After this, the hotel changed hands several more times until 1997, when it was purchased by its current owners, Marty and Elise Rowanjik. They purchased the building in hopes of keeping it from falling into ruin and set out a 20-year plan to restore and revitalize the hotel. In 2000, they hosted a banquet called The Dawning of the Crescent's Second Golden Age, where they unveiled the hotel's creed: create lifetime memories, build the individual, protect the irreplaceable, and be community-minded. In their plan, they wanted to restore it in phases. In the 20-year project, they have restored guest rooms, built restaurants, made bridal suites, and even have a spa. The Crescent Hotel and Spa is now a one-stop shop for all of your needs, even the paranormal. When restorations began, the Rowanjiks hired two mediums to survey the property because they had been experiencing some unusual sort of activity. What they found sparked the idea to create a nightly ghost tour for visitors, one of which you can still go on. One of the mediums, Ken Fugate, believed that there was a portal to the spirit realm directly over the morgue that Norman Baker disposed of his cancer patients. That morgue is still you can still visit that morgue and see the autopsies and everything like that. Visitors are known to grow very weak and even faint when passing over this spot. Other sightings are of a little boy hiding under an autopsy table begging for help, the sound of squeaking wheels of a gurney on the third floor, glimpses of a former patient in room 419, whose name is believed to be Teresa, and many EVP conversations with former patients. I'm going to post some pictures of apparitions captured on the Instagram page if you're interested in seeing those. They are really, really, really good. So if you haven't followed that page yet, you need to. And I will put the Instagram name in the show notes. It seems that all of the paranormal activity at the Crescent Hotel is linked to the madman Norman Baker. Instead of finding a cure, his patients have found an eternity of entrapment. When researching this week, I found a baking recipe from the Crescent Hotel. So if you're interested in this recipe, grab a pen and paper so you can jot it down. So found in the Ford Treasury of Favorite Recipes from Famous Eating Places, published by the Ford Motor Company of Dearborn, Michigan in 1950, and distributed locally by Crow Motor Company of Eureka Springs, was a recipe from the Crescent Hotel. The copy reads as follows. Huckleberry muffins. You need 1 cup of huckleberries, 2 cups of flour, 1/3 cup of shortening, 4 teaspoons of baking powder, 1 cup of milk, and 1 egg. Wash and drain huckleberries and sprinkle with 1/2 teaspoon of flour. Sift dry ingredients and cut in shortening. To this, add milk and beaten egg. Stir floured berries in quickly. Don't mash them. Bake in hot greased muffin pan for 20 minutes in a moderate oven. Blueberries can be substituted. Pop a batch in the oven for a Sunday morning breakfast surprise. Well, I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. I know it was a long one, but that story of Norman Baker is just so fascinating to me. How he could captivate and defraud so many people, and then the fact that his defraudment led to paranormal activity in this building is amazing. Tune back in next week for a true crime monster. Stay safe, make good choices, and say no to scammers.